Great. Well, good morning. I hadn't realised, actually, this is my second time here doing things with Lane. I hadn't realised that you folks were basically Baptists, because you're all sitting in rows 2 and 3, and only 2 people are brave.
And the
Anglican
and the Pentecostal on the front row.
The Anglican and Pentecostal on the front row.
Well, yeah, we're not talking about Baptists.
Well, that's good, so I'm glad to know there aren't actually any Baptists in the room. I mean, I love a hostile audience as much as the next person, but, you know, Baptists on a Saturday morning, that's just too much. There we are, we'll pray for you later. No, that's good. Just out of interest, who was there last night? Oh, a whole bunch of you. Excellent. Okay. Wonderful. Well, hopefully some of what we covered this morning will kind of tie in with some of last night. Quick housekeeping announcement before we start. We're going to cover quite a lot of material this morning. So while I speak, I'm going to send around a little clipboard. Nick, do you want to just start with that? The way this works, if you put your email address down on that clipboard, we will do 2 things for you. One is we will sell your email to Google and make lots of money. We have to fund the organisation that I work for somehow. No, more seriously, what I'll do, I'll send you a copy of the slides from this morning as a PDF. So whether you're Mac or PC or your laptop or a mobile device or whatever you have, you'll be able to read them. And that will mean some of the quotes and sort of things that we go through, you won't have to try and write down at high speed. You'll be able to go through those at your leisure. So in terms of this first kind of topic this morning, this is something I've been speaking quite a lot of late. I started my sort of speaking career doing a lot of the traditional topics, you know, how do we convince people God exists and the problem of evil and why they're Baptists in the world, and, you know, all these kind of questions. And they're interesting, but actually I find a lot of the questions we're getting from secular friends, from friends who don't have a belief in Christ, from the culture on the university campuses, are actually much more interesting ones than some of those older, more traditional questions. And this whole question of what it means to be a human being is fascinating, and it's a really interesting question to get us into spiritual territory with our friends. I hope we'll see that as we go. And so I've called this morning's first talk, Are We Matter or Do We Matter? And to set the scene for that, there was a recent poll done for an internet search company. I think it probably was Google. And they ranked the various questions that people were asking and tried to basically answer the question, what is the hardest question in the world to answer? And they came up with the answer that the question, what is the meaning of life, is the toughest question in the world. That came number one in this poll of questions by Google. That beat other surprising questions, actually. That came above other puzzling questions like, what is love? I think that was number 3 on the list. It beat out questions like, why is abbreviation such a long word? I wondered about that one. I mean, that's really is, really. And then I think one of the most troubling questions of all for me was much lower down the list, and that's, why do you never see baby pigeons? Ever wondered that? Ever seen a baby pigeon? I've never seen one. I think they just inflate like alien popcorn. But anyway, what is the meaning of life? Beat all of those questions. And of course, to ask the question, what is the meaning of life, is to ask the question of purpose. It's to ask what the purpose of human existence is. And of course, it's purpose by which we tell whether something is good or bad. I don't know if you've noticed this. For example, if you were to talk to me during the coffee break, and I were to say to you, you know, I'm really actually quite cross today, and despite the fact that I look like a jolly kind of chap, and you say, Andy, why are you cross this morning? And I say, well, last week, back in Scotland, I went to the local jewellery store, and they sold me a bad watch. They sold me a bad watch that ripped me off. And you would say to me, well, Andy, what do you mean by bad watch? Why was it a bad watch? And I would say to you, well, you know, last week I was trying to put up a new set of shelves for my wife, and I was hammering in nails with my new watch, and I broke it. It's now in pieces. It's a bad watch. What would you say? I suspect some of you might say, would you like the number of a good psychiatrist here in Liverpool? We can help you with this delusion. Or I suspect some of you might, you know, a bit more reflective, say, Andy, you've misunderstood the purpose of a watch. The purpose of a watch is to tell the time, and we tell whether a watch is a good watch or a bad watch by how well it does that. And of course, if that's true of things like watches, presumably the same is true of a human being. There are bad ways to be a human being, there are good ways to be a human being, but we can't answer that question unless we know the purpose of a human life, what the purpose of a human life is intended to be. We can't talk about good and evil, right and wrong, and so on and so forth. So what is a human being? Now, many of my atheist friends are very keen to answer that question purely in material terms, not so much as allowing God even a foot in the door. Let me give you a couple of examples. This first quotation is from a gentleman called Francis Crick. And Francis is one of the co-discoverers of the DNA molecule. So incredibly famous Nobel Prize winning scientist. Committed atheist. And this is his answer to the question, what is a human being? Francis says, your joy and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are nothing more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. As Lewis Carroll's Alice might have put it, you are nothing but a pack of neurons. To encourage you this morning. I hope, I don't know if any of you, when you got up this morning and looked in the mirror as you got washed this morning, thought to yourself, I am nothing but a pack of neurons, but I'm going to go and have a pastry at the church anyway.
A few more neurons.
And so that's Francis Crick. Now, he's not alone. There are others who've said similar things. So the biologist turned celebrity atheist, Richard Dawkins, put it this way. He said, we are survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. Our genes made us. We animals exist for their preservation, and we are nothing more than throwaway survival machines. Again, I wonder if any of you looked in the mirror this morning and thought, my word, I'm nothing more than a throwaway survival machine. But there we are, isn't life wonderful? Now, of course, if Crick and Dawkins are right, that raises some pretty profound questions, really. Some quite disturbing questions. A few weeks ago, I was in Plymouth doing a week of mission down there, and Nick is very gracious. He's only asked me to speak 4 times in 3 days. In Plymouth, they had me speak 21 times in 6 days. I remember on the first night at the church, they were talking about the schedule for the week. And I remember sitting there in the front pew thinking, well, I feel a bit sorry for that guy. And then I realised I was that guy. part of the places that we spoke that week, we did lots of events in schools and went into the local high schools and did RS lessons and so forth. And one of the lessons we did in one of the high schools in Plymouth, we got the kids thinking about this very question. And I had about sort of 30 year 11s in the class, and I threw up this picture on the screen. This is Bibi Aisha. And Bibi was a young Afghani girl who, aged just 14, was forced into a marriage with a Taliban fighter, aged about 50, almost 60. And he proceeded to horribly, horribly abuse her. And after suffering 4 years of violence, she ran away. But she was soon captured. And her husband and other family members then hacked off her nose, hacked off her ears, and left her to die out in the mountains, where thankfully she was picked up by a UN aid worker and rescued. And I put her picture from the cover of Time magazine on the screen, and I said to these year 11s, I said, was what happened to her wrong? Now, thankfully, most of the year 11s said yes. A few of them, quite frighteningly, said, well, maybe that's okay in her culture, which is quite sort of terrifying response. But what was fascinating was when I asked sort of 95% of the students who said what happened to her was wrong, I said, why was it wrong? Why is it wrong what happened to her? Not a single student could give me an answer to the question of why it was wrong. Some of them sort of said, well, it sort of just is, for those who were confident enough to press to answer. And as I pressed them harder and harder, I was basically trying to push them to the conclusion of saying, look, do you not see that if human beings are just matter, just atoms and particles, then why does what happens to them actually matter? You know, if I bring in an angle grinder and cut the top off the leptone here, I've rearranged atoms. If I bring in a chainsaw and take the top off Nick's head, I've rearranged atoms. For one, they arrest me. For another, the church just send me a bill for a new leptone. But what's the difference? And we'll do this experiment live tomorrow in church. I would say, look, don't get me wrong. I admire the honesty of Francis Crick. I admire the honesty of Richard Dawkins. Their worldview leads to staggeringly bleak conclusions, Their atheism leads them to a very dark place. But at least appreciate their honesty, even if they can't answer the question, what does it mean to be human? So what's the Christian answer to this question? If naturalistic atheism that just tries to say there is no God, everything is just atoms and particles and matter, if that fails to really help us out, what does the Bible say? Does it offer us anything? Well, in the very first book of the Bible, the very first page, actually, the very first book of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, we read a statement that is mind-blowing in its scope and foundational in its importance. You'll all recognize these words, I'm sure. The book of Genesis says, "Then God said, let us make humankind in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground." And so God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And this claim here on the screen, that human beings are made in the image of God, that we bear the imago Dei, to use the theological term, it's unique to Christianity. I've been studying the Quran for 20 years academically. You won't find a statement anything like this in the Quran of Islam. You won't find it in other scriptures. You won't find it in the Hindu Vedas or the Bhagavad Gita or in any other religious text. Only the Bible makes this staggering claim that human beings are a very, very special thing indeed. But this is not merely some theological idea up here on the screen. This is hugely foundational for two reasons. What the book of Genesis says here is foundational for human value, and it's foundational when it comes to ethics. I'd like to explore both those with us just for a few minutes this morning. Let's start with value for a moment. The first thing that the biblical claim that human beings are made in the image of God, and not just atoms and particles, does, is it gives us a rock solid, concrete, unshakable, objective foundation for your value and identity. So according to the Bible, it doesn't matter what gender you are, it doesn't matter what race you are, it doesn't matter what your creed or your colour or your age or your ability or thankfully your height is, it doesn't matter what you earn, it doesn't matter what you've done, it doesn't matter what your record is, all of us are made in the image of God and have incredible value and dignity. Now, I often say to my atheist friends, take that idea away. If you eliminate that, you're left with a question: how do you determine the value of the human life? Well, how might we determine a human life purely in atheistic terms? Maybe if I was a chemist, for example, I could drag Nick, because he's sitting there in the front row, we could drag him away to my secret laboratory buried deep in the caves underneath Liverpool. Every Bond villain needs a secret lair. And I could put Nick into a large test tube, and we'd boil him up to his chemical constituents, so much sodium, so much potash, so much phosphorus, so much iron, so much fat, so much fat. And it's been calculated, funny thing is the next talk's the resurrection, so we can really do the head thing. It's been calculated that the average human being consists of something like £5 worth of chemicals. And those are pre-Brexit prices, so that's likely to go down. That's the bad news. That doesn't really work. I don't think any of us would really say a human life is worth £5. So how else might we do it? Well, I guess if I was a psychologist, maybe we could measure how smart each of us are. And we could value one another by our IQ. The cleverer you are, the more valued you are, and so on and so forth. But again, most of us would think that's a monstrous way to value human life. Well, how else could we do it? Well, I guess maybe if we were anthropologists, maybe we could count how many friends each of you have, both the real variety and the pretend ones that you accumulate on social media, and value, you know, your life in terms of your popularity. But again, that looks a bit problematic. What are we left with if there is no God? Well, I guess finally, if we were economists, and of course an economist is somebody who can tell you tomorrow why the prediction they made yesterday is wrong today. Maybe an economist might look at your salary, what you produce, how much you're worth, and assess the value of your life that way. And of course the interesting thing is, whether I'm talking to a Christian audience, or whether I do this version of this talk on, you know, university campuses to secular audiences, everybody instinctively knows those are terrible ways to value a human life. You know, your value is not determined from your chemical constituents that make you up, how much you earn, how smart you are, number of friends you have. If we go that route, we're all in trouble, unless you're a grossly overweight lawyer with great social networking skills, but there we are. But I ask my atheist friends, if not those ways, what way? You see, there's only one place I know, only one way I know we can value human life that truly locates human value properly, and that's in the biblical teaching about human beings bearing the image of God. Because only that tells you that your value as a human being comes not from your performance, from what you do, but actually from the outside, and gives us that incredible foundation. So the book of Genesis and its teaching that we bear the image of God gives us a foundation for value. It also gives us a foundation for ethics, and something that's closely connected, how we treat one another. The question I put to those Year 11 students in Plymouth a few weeks ago, and it's a fascinating question. How do we ground and give a foundation to this entrenched belief we have that we should treat everybody, certainly our friends and our neighbours, but also those in distant countries, in fact even those who are our enemies, with generosity and compassion? How do we find a basis for that hugely important idea? Well, among all the world's peoples, the Dalits of India have suffered some of the greatest suffering, pain, sadness and persecution over the generations. The Dalits, if you've never heard of them, sit at the bottom of India's highly stratified caste system, and they are considered untouchable. Dalit women often bear the brunt of this, and two-thirds of Dalit women have been sexually abused, and 750,000 trafficked into sexual slavery. Yet the conviction crime in India for crimes against Dalits is about 5%. And that raises an interesting question. How do you change the mindset that says that a person is literally worthless because of her caste, because of her family, because of her birthplace? It's all very well to come out with high-sounding platitudes like all people are born equal, but what does that mean to people who suffer daily persecution and discrimination? I was reading an interview with a Dalit religious leader recently who summed their problem up. He said, our problem as a community is by the time that one of our children is 14 years old, it's too late almost to change anything, because they've been told their entire life that they are worth less. He said, the only way to correct this, he continued, is from a very, very, very young age, when they're very, very tiny, to speak into their minds and speak into their ears and speak into their lives a different worldview that can actually give them value. Now, the Dalits are finding that it's the biblical worldview and this idea that all of us bear God's image that is a powerful corrective. And hundreds of thousands of men, and particularly women and children from this community in India, are becoming Christians because of what it says about their value and their dignity. So if you tell a child their entire life that they're worthless, there will be consequences. Here in the West, we're trying a different sociological experiment. We're trying to see what will happen if you raise a generation of young people to believe that they are just nothing but a pack of neurons, just dancing to their DNA, just accidental collections of atoms, and so on and so forth. I often think we may be unpleasantly surprised to discover what happens when they grow up, become our future leaders, and possibly begin acting out that philosophy out there in the world. I do wonder what that might look like. So this question of what it means to be human is profoundly important. And I believe that only the Bible can answer that question in any meaningful way, telling us that we're not reducible to atoms and molecules, our psychology and sociology, to what we do or what we earn. But there's one other side to the question, what it means to be human, that I want to spend sort of 5 minutes or so addressing. And it touched on something that came up last night a few times, actually, at the golf club. And it's the fact that if we're going to talk about what it means to be human, we don't just need a basis for our nobility and our value as human beings, we also need something that addresses the fact that we're flawed. See, one of the challenges for secularism and for atheism is explaining the fact that human beings seem to go wrong in all kinds of ways. It doesn't matter how much education, how much politics, how much technology you apply, we do not arrive at secular utopias. Human beings just use technology to do wrong to each other in new ways. As the poet Randall Jarrell once wrote, he said, most of us know now that Rousseau was wrong, that man, when you knock his chains off, sets up the death camps. Soon we shall know everything the 18th century didn't know and nothing that it did. And it'll be very hard to live with us. If this is true, if it is that actually the more freedom and more technology we give to human beings, the more we use those to hurt one another, why is that true? If human beings are made in the image of God, as I've been stressing for the last 20 minutes, why are we so often beastly to one another? Well, here it may be interesting to reflect on the idea of the word image for a moment. Inherent in the word image is the idea of reflection. So if human beings were created in God's image, that means we were designed, we were intended, we were purposed to reflect God, to image God, to reflect God's glory to the world. And so the question for every human being then becomes, well, what do you choose to reflect? And to my atheist friends, if you choose not to reflect God, what are you going to reflect? All of us angle the mirror of our souls at something, and if it isn't God, it's probably going to be things like work, or performance, or money, or image, or even like Narcissus of Greek legend, you know, we become so transfixed by our own image, our own beauty, our own cleverness, our own reputation, we have no time for anybody else. But of course, all of those things will ultimately destroy you, because no mirror can actually be the source of its own light. Many of you, as we noted at the start, were there last night at the golf club, and in one of the questions towards the end, I quoted this gentleman. This is David Foster Wallace, very famous novelist, atheist, committed atheist, but famous novelist and writer, and died 10 years ago, took his own life very tragically, not least because I think he realised the implications of his atheism and couldn't live with them. But David wrote very, very wisely on the human condition and on what it means to be human, and actually wrote one of the most insightful paragraphs on human life that I've ever read anywhere among secularists or Christians. And I quoted him last night, and I'm going to quote him again for you this morning. And the quote, several people actually came up to me last night and said, can I get this quotation? And if you give me your email address, I will send you the slides, and you'll have David's quotation, because it's a fascinating one to read to atheist friends and get their perspective, because David was an atheist. Here's what he wrote. David wrote, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money, and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. If you worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. And I think what David Foster Wallace is nudging at here is the fact that whatever is the source of your meaning and your satisfaction, your energy, your joy, well, you have to have it. You need it. And you're afraid of losing it. And because of that, the prospect of losing it, whether it's a standard of living or some particular relationship, or your job, or your academic reputation, whatever it is, that thing ends up controlling you because you absolutely have to have it. But the problem is that if you end up worshipping or serving your career, or your success, or your image, or your performance, and you fail, as many of us do, you will end up crucifying you inside, with hatred and anxiety and jealousy and self-loathing. And it was interesting in Plymouth a few weeks ago. I told you a couple of stories from there. We did a men's breakfast event one morning. I suddenly realised actually breakfast events are always in the morning, aren't they? Do a men's breakfast event in the evening, that would be interesting. And we had about 60 people there at the church about this size, and about half the audience weren't Christians. And I was speaking that morning on the pursuit of happiness, how we can find happiness and meaning and satisfaction in life. Beforehand, I had this fascinating conversation over the breakfast table with a gentleman who was there, who was a friend of one of the people in the church, not a Christian, but spiritually quite open. And he said, the reason I've come today, he said, is the question intrigued me when I saw it on the poster. He said, because you described my life. He said, the past 10 years, my dream in life, my goal, my ambition, everything I've been living for has been to pay the mortgage off early. That was the gift I wanted to give my family. I worked two jobs, occasionally three jobs. I burnt the candle at both ends and the middle, worked incredibly hard, payment after payment. And he said, I actually succeeded. I paid the mortgage off for 10 years, not 25. He said, just last month, I went into the building society with the final check to pay off the mortgage, handed it in debt-free. He said, I thought that would be the most exciting moment of my entire life. I've been living for this for 10 years. He said, I thought this would be the top of the mountain. He said, I have never been so depressed in my entire life. He said, I walked out of that building society almost in tears, thinking, now what do I do? I've got nothing left to live for. He said, I need to find something that's worth living for. He said, I'm here this morning hoping you might be able to give me some clues as to what that is. Those things, if we try and serve them, will crucify us inside with anxiety, self-loathing, depression, all those kind of things. By contrast, the heart of the Christian faith stands as incredible news that Jesus, by contrast, was crucified for us. So what's the solution? How can we deal with the fact that the mirror of our souls is cracked and broken and distorted? Well, of course, the great news is that the biblical theme of the image of God that begins in Genesis runs throughout the whole of the Bible and into the New Testament, and we find the answer to that question. Now, where the New Testament says that it's Jesus, the true image of God, who offers us the ability to be restored back into that from which we have fallen and that from which we have lost. According to the Bible, Jesus Christ is the perfect image of God and was willing to be trampled on, broken, rejected, broken for us, so that our broken image might be remade, forgiven, restored and redeemed. And the story of Jesus' death and resurrection are their hearts about restoration, about God's offer, God's promise, God's power to restore that image of God that we have allowed to become so marred and twisted in us. If all we had was Genesis chapter 1, we would know that human beings are unique, that we have value, that we have dignity, and that's great. But we'd have no way to get back to that image from which we've fallen. It would be quite depressing, really, going, well, that's what we're supposed to be, but we clearly aren't there. But the Bible tells us the whole story, the story of what God has done about that problem in Jesus and the cross. And in the face of secular myths and atheistic legends that would reduce us to matter, just material, just atoms and particles, the Bible tells us that we're not reduced, but we're redeemed. Redeemed through what God has done in Jesus and the true image of God on the cross. The wonderful news that we can share with our friends is that human beings are not just atoms. We are not just matter. We are more than the stuff of which we are made, more than our economic production, more than the number of relationships we have, more than our biology, more than our psychology, more than our moral performance. We are image bearers with incredible value and incredible dignity, that value so high that Jesus was willing to pay the price of his life to redeem and restore that broken image, so that the mirror of our souls might be angled at him and the true image of, reflect the true image of God as it was intended. That's why human beings aren't just matter, but we do matter because of the price that Jesus paid for each one of us while we were still his enemies. As Paul puts it so beautifully in Romans 5, verse 8, God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Amen. Well, here endeth the first lesson. Look at that, right on time, half an hour. So what we're going to do, Nick's dashing up to make the coffee. We're going to have time, a little bit of time for some Q&A later. What I want to do while Nick makes the coffee, and then we have a break, and then we have a second session looking at the resurrection and how we can talk to our friends who are not Christians about the resurrection and why there are very good reasons to think it happened. One of the things I always love to do when I do these kind of events is talk a little bit about the organisation I work for. So Nick said, oh, I'll go make the coffee, and you told him about Solas for a few minutes, because I love talking to audiences like yourselves, but I get also excited about the kind of audiences we had last night. And also not many people have heard of who I work for. So I'd like to just for a few moments talk to you about the Solas Centre for Public Christianity. We're an evangelistic organisation based in Scotland, about 3 hours north of here. And two things really we get excited about. So that's, we do evangelism, and you saw some of that in action last night, and we do evangelism training, especially evangelism that gets out of the four walls of the churches and into the public square. And I said to Nick, when he invited me up to come to Liverpool for a second time and do last night's event for you, I get so excited when I hear of churches doing events like Lane did last night at the golf club. Because so often we put on little events in our churches, we perhaps have an evangelistic Sunday morning sermon, and we hope that non-Christians will come through the door, and they never do. But if you go where they are, they often show up. And it was great to see so many people there last night who were not believers. And we love to do that kind of evangelism. At SOLAS, we like to do evangelism that takes people's questions seriously, that really engages with the questions they're asking, and explains the gospel persuasively with clarity. And then we like to do events like this morning, evangelism training, that begins to perhaps help folks like yourselves think about some of the questions that are out there, and think about ways to share your faith in a way that's natural, that engages with the issues that are important to your friends and your neighbours and your colleagues. I often think, what would it look like if every Christian in the UK, because we think the church is small, but there's a lot of us, if every Christian in the UK had the confidence to talk about Jesus naturally with their friends and their neighbours and colleagues, what would that look like? I think it would be incredible. Because what events like last night show me is that people are hungry. There's a hunger out there, actually, more than we might realise among our secular friends. I think people are figuring out now, several generations of living in a post-Christian society, that actually many of the deepest questions to life are not answered by 24/7, internet, reality TV, and endless shopping. There are actually questions that are deeper than that, and that's why SOLAS exists. And some of the opportunities we find are incredible. So last night was amazing. I mean, most of you were there. But a few weeks ago, I did a very similar event at this place, the University of Glasgow. And it's very interesting. Actually, I drove down there on a wet and dark and cold Scottish summer day, really. Tuesday night, it was about a 2-hour drive, and I was going with a friend of mine. We were doing this event together, and they'd asked us to come and speak to some students there. And I confess, all the way there we grumbled, because we were tired, we both had busy weeks. We're like, why are we going? They all turn up, it's Tuesday, it's wet, it's Glasgow. Well, boy were we in for a surprise, because we got there and discovered that the local Christian Union had hired Glasgow Union Building, filled it with 160 people, plus coffee, plus desserts, and about 60% of them were not Christian. And we answered questions for 2 hours. You guys got off light last night in 50 minutes. 2 hours they kept myself and my friend there. And just incredible conversations. And another hour afterwards, dealing with people one-on-one, got to pray with people. In fact, my colleague actually got to pray with a Muslim gentleman who'd come on that evening. And the Muslim guy's comment to my friend at the end, he said, look, I'm not ready to leave Islam and follow Jesus, he said, but I'm beginning to think I may have to in due course. Could you pray with me that I would have the courage to follow where I may need to? My friend afterwards was just unbelievably excited. And all the way back from Glasgow to Dundee, we felt we had to pray and repent for our attitude on the way down. So that was an incredible night. Last year we were here, a few of you who caught me last year may recall I was here, but to an admission at Liverpool Hope University. That was what brought me to Liverpool last year, and we tacked on events here at the church. And just amazing, actually, the number of non-Christians we saw come to events at the university. And just last week, actually, just 10 days ago, I was doing a university mission at another university, and we had an incredible opportunity to see a young man from an entirely non-church background come to faith across the university mission week. And the amazing thing is often the stories come afterwards. The guy who had this conversion experience was actually willing to tell his story on camera. So I want to share with you a one-minute video from a gentleman called Ashwant. He was a liberal Hindu at the start of the week. By the end of the week, let him tell his own story in his own words.
When I walked into it that first session, I walked in as a normal 18-year-old student worried about exams. I didn't care much about God at all. I was on my way to the dining hall, and I passed by these people in a yellow shirt. They said, hey, you want free food? I said, okay, it's better than standing in the free line. So we'll go get some free food. And I went up there with no interest in Jesus, who this is, and I sat there. And 1 hour later, after hearing these people speak about love and good news, there was some thirst in me, and I wanted to know who this Jesus was. And then here, 24 hours later, I'm standing here with the love of Jesus, with a thirst to know Jesus, and with the Bible in my bag. And this was just in one day. What happened in that one day? I mean, all the people I've met from reading or to have answered my questions beautifully, and they've been supported. Maybe 1 year from now, I might even be Christian. Thank you.
the end. He, yes, towards the end of our time talking and praying at the end of the evening, he said, I can see myself being a Christian in a year's time. And 10 minutes later, he was praying to receive Christ. One of my colleagues looked at him and went, well, what's the question you need answered? He said, do you believe that Jesus is Lord? Yes, I do. Do you believe he died and rose from the dead? Yes, I do. Do you believe that you're a sinner and need a forgiveness? Oh, very much so. Well, you're ready to go. And off he went. So he is now following Christ. I just love that story, the joy in that young man. So as well as university events, we do events in all kinds of strange places. Last night we were in the golf club. A few weeks ago I was doing a similar event with a church up in Scotland who had the brainwave of hiring a local Indian restaurant for the night. That was a lot of fun. We had a curry and a conversation. And that was fun actually. We had 50 seats in the restaurant, 54 people showed up, which was so a very close fellowship. Lots of curry, lots of Indian beer, and me. And we were going till about midnight actually answering people's questions and folks signing up for Alpha. We do events in pubs. One of my favourite places is just down the road from where I live in Scotland. There's a pub run in Stirling in Scotland by Australians, so they call it the Kilted Kangaroo. Great name for a pub. And we do events in there quite frequently. A few weeks ago, actually, not this topic, we did an event there that night looking at the problem of evil. We titled it, Where is God Where is God in Aleppo? And we had about 45 people came, about half of them were non-Christian. And a bit like last night's Q&A, for those of you who were there last night, you'll remember Chris, the quite zippy young atheist from that front table last night, who kind of made the evening, actually. We had one of those in Stirling. And what was amazing was afterwards, she asked for a copy of my book. And I got a message from the pastor who'd organised the event a week later that she'd sat up all night reading my book on atheism and was now meeting regularly with the pastor to talk about faith, her final objections answered. So sometimes the louder they come, the harder they fall. We do as well as stuff in pubs and like last night, universities do stuff online. If you haven't discovered our short answer videos, do take a look on the CLS website. These are great for sharing with friends. If you're on social media, if you're on Facebook, share them on your Facebook feed. They're free of charge. Download them, use them as you will, and they're great conversation starters. It's also great to have you on a phone if you want to talk about Jesus with a friend or a colleague and you worry what would happen if they asked you a question you couldn't answer. More short answers there to help you. And we've had about 450,000 downloads on those videos in the last year or so, which is hugely exciting. We also do lots of online other kind of bits and pieces. So a few weeks ago I had the privilege of debating the world's leading atheist philosopher Peter Singer, and that's up online on the Premier Unbelievable website near Premier Radio. Just go to Premier and then follow the word Unbelievable and you'll follow through and see the link. And just been so excited by the emails and conversations we've had from atheists who've watched that and been struck by some of the things that both that I said and also that Justin Brierley, who's the host of that show, who's a Christian, said. So all kinds of incredible opportunities coming through SOLAS. And we're a unique organisation. There are evangelistic organisations like ours based in places like London and Oxford and South East. But we are unique. We're based in Scotland, but also a huge passion for the north of England as well. Many of my southern colleagues haven't discovered there is life north of Birmingham. And I think that's the best bits of the country, actually. Funny thing was, I used to think Liverpool was the north. Now I live in Dundee. You guys are southerners. But you're not southerners. Kind of thing. There's huge opportunities up here. But we're amazing. We've got lots of exciting future plans for the organisation. We want to grow the next generation of young evangelists. We turn away 3 invitations for every one we accept, which kind of breaks our hearts tremendously. So we want to grow the next generation of kind of younger northern evangelists to raise up men and women, not just in Scotland, but across the north of England as well, who can really take the gospel into the places it needs to go. We want to grow our social media presence. We think there's huge opportunities to reach more people online. So many younger people live their lives online. And I think as Christians, we need to go where people are. And then to really deepen our evangelism training. We do a lot of days like today, but we're planning to launch a curriculum for churches that can work through small groups to take the material that we've done today and go much deeper with folks like yourselves to really help people get relaxed and come to grips with sharing their faith naturally with their friends. And all of that we do with a tiny, tiny team. There are 1.9 of us, basically, up there. I'm the one and there's a 0.9 up in Scotland with various people doing various things. And we can only do what we do with the support of friends and people who pray for us and get involved with us across the country. So sort of a final little plea, really. If you've enjoyed last night and if you enjoy today and you get excited about the idea of Christians going where non-Christians are and helping churches do what they're doing, just really sort of cheeky plea if you'd consider perhaps prayerfully supporting us. On your seat, you'll find a little A5 form that you can fill in. If you agree to support us for as little as £3 a month, that's all we're asking, not kind of huge amounts of money, the price of a coffee at Starbucks, or maybe 1.5 coffees at McDonald's, you can make a huge difference to us. And as a gift to you, if you sign up today and grab me before you go, I will give you a free book. And it genuinely is free because we've had a donor give us 500 of these to give away to people who support SOLAS. So £3 a month, if you give me that form completed before the end of the morning, I will give you this book, Why We Still Believe. Lots of essays and chapters on everything from personal evangelism to God and science and all the kind of things we talked about last night and today as a kind of thank you. Anyway, the hero at the end of the second lesson. Nick, is that coffee I can smell wafting through? Yeah.